Well, Senator Michicki, thank you so much for dropping by today. Good to see you as always.
It's a pleasure to be here, Shaylin. Thanks for the invite.
And want to get to it and talk about the special session that's going on right now. Kind of bring us up to speed. What's going on? I know the crime bill is being hotly debated within the House anyway, and some movement there. Tell us what's going on down in Juneau right now.
So, as you know, we went down to Juneau. The Senate went down at the onset of the session. We realized that Senate Bill 54, the improvements to the Senate Bill 91 crime bill, was going to be dealt with by the House first. We passed that bill on April 7th, 7 months ago. So we decided to send everyone home, get them off of per diem. We've watched the progress through the House process. They passed the bill last night. I believe the final vote was 32-8 in support. They did some very good things to the bill. You know, our focus was increasing the sentencing for C felonies and escalating penalties for the repeat misdemeanors, accountability for technical violations. So, in my view, the House did a very good job improving that bill. I think we have some exposures, some partially caused by Senate Bill 91, some just caused by the opioid crisis and the increased related lower-level crimes. Remember, 91 increased penalties for the most serious crimes. But I think they did a very good job, and I'm glad they passed the bill with that level of support. I am flying down tonight. And we will bring the Senate together to review all of the changes in detail. My first impression of the work that they have done is that I'm going to support their changes. We'll see if there's any outliers there. I don't necessarily care what it's going to cost. I think those are the results of their processing has been a better outcome. I think it'll do a better job for accountability for those that choose to break the law, whether or not it's substance related. It improves some of the treatment options, yet folks are going to be held accountable even on very low levels. It comes with the escalators that we encouraged, and I'm looking forward to working through that process over the next few days. I believe it'll end up on the Senate bill, Senate floor, relatively unchanged from the hard work the House has done. I think they've done a good job.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a little bit about that because going back to you and representatives Gary Knopp, Mike Chenault had a little legislative town hall meeting here some time ago before the legislative session, and I was actually kind of surprised at how many folks came out to that meeting and did have such strong feelings about Senate Bill 91 and what they felt the effects of that bill were here sort of locally. And one of the things that came up a lot was this idea of crime related to opioid addiction and those sorts of things. And are there more or less, or talk a little bit about some of the treatment options or some of those other sorts of follow-up things that come along with this crime reform bill, because that was something that we heard a lot of in that town hall meeting was we agree that these folks are kind of stuck in the cycle. So what part of this bill is doing anything to help them get out of it in terms of rehab, treatment, those sorts of things?
Well, so this is interesting. You know, I remember the crime meetings we began having, I did before I was even elected, joined up with Ann Crogson from Nikiski when some of these property crimes began. I mean, the increase began in 2011.
Yes.
We began trying to deal with it in 13 and 14. I passed Senate Bill 5 when I first got into the legislature in 15, and that was about restitution. There was no way to recoup your losses from as a victim of crime. So the increase began back then. We're seeing a nationwide increase related to the opioid crisis. Some states have seen increases as high as 2,600% in 1 year. So I'm not going to say that Senate Bill 91 caused the increase in crime, because it didn't. However, it's certainly not going to help when we're not holding people accountable. So we largely, although we didn't decriminalize possession of the most serious substances, we made it so that they were going to get a slap on the wrist and not be required to have a treatment plan. And we missed the boat on that one. The reality of it is, if we're going to help those people, remember what this bill was about. It's about separating the wheat from the chaff. Bad people need to go to prison. They need to stay there till they're no longer a threat to public safety. This is for the lower level folks that may have a substance abuse problem. However, before we were sending them as part of their conditions of release, they were going to get treatment. If they went through successfully and they no longer offended, they could go on to a successful life. We no longer have that stick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have a carrot without a stick. So the new Senate Bill 54 is going to return some of those options. Now, we simply can't afford to send every person through treatment. There has to be some personal responsibility. Yet, I believe that the work that we did in 54 and the improved work that the House did in 54 will give more hope for those folks that have made a poor choice on becoming a member of the addiction club and finding themselves with no way out.
Yeah, and it is such a tough one because it's when you're trying to deal with a problem of that type at such a scale, to individually tailor things to the individual needs of those people is really tough, and financially it's very, very difficult to sustain. And so these are all parts of the things that go into sort of the politics of trying to get a bill like this hammered out.
Well, there's no question, and you can just say you're tough on crime. And Shailen, I don't know how much you've followed me. I'm tough on crime. But what does that mean? I want the people that are a public safety risk off the streets, but we simply can't afford to throw everyone in prison that's had a minor offense forever, right? So we have to have development plans that are going to intervene on the lower level cases. They must be held accountable, yet there has to be a way to move on with their lives. Because when you think about it, you put someone in prison, you keep them there, suddenly the state is responsible for maintaining the lifestyle of the rest of their family. We need to get these folks so that they're no longer addicted to whatever substance is their choice, which is 90% of these crimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol and drug-related. Get them the treatment they need, get them back to work, and get them leading a productive lifestyle. If they continue to choose the wrong path, whether it's just substance related or it moves on to the other crimes, you know, whether it's theft or moving on to those other crimes, then they must pay the consequences and be removed from being a public safety or property risk to those of us that choose to go to work every day and follow the law. But nonetheless, Senate Bill 91, Senate Bill 54 aside, we have a lot of work to do. We have a problem, just like every other state in the union. However, I believe that this state should be one of the simplest on controlling the flow of drugs into this state. We have limited connectivity with other states. They're coming on the ferry. They're coming on an airplane to the village. We have ways to be more effective on interrupting that flow and keeping people from ever starting down that road, because it's, you know, some of the best families on the Kenai have been adversely affected. No one is immune anymore. We need to do what we can to keep that from being a problem in someone's life. And that's where I think we need to invest a lot more aside from these bills.
Right. And you mentioned the work that the House has done to sort of revamp and address some of these things. And you have support for that work as well. Do you see that being carrying across the rest of the Senate? Is there yet a lot of work to be done to get this thing through the Senate?
Well, I'm the majority leader of a group that is diverse in their belief systems, right?
That's a nice way to put that, yes.
I have some work to do. There are folks that believe Senate Bill 91 was perfect just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
As you saw with the vote, if you look at the aid, it's fairly evenly split between D's and R's, if you will.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating. The Democrats believe that the law needs to be more lenient. The Republicans believe that it needs to be much stricter. We have that same collection in our group, so I'm going to be, I'm going this evening, first thing in the morning, I will be creating a side-by-side document so people can make the comparisons between what we passed in 54, which was 19-1 in the Senate. It passed 19-1 on April 7th, explaining the differences, the value of those differences. I'm hoping to have the same type of vote this time. same level of support, and it's going to cost money. Solving these issues is going to cost money. I did not support Senate Bill 91 because it saved money. I supported Senate Bill 91 because I believe it's going to have a long-term better outcome in reducing crime in this state, like it did in Texas and several other states. However, we had that perfect storm. They changed the bail schedule at the same time, which lightened those that are going to be charged and convicted and what they would have to serve with the Department of Corrections. It's sort of a perfect storm as crime increased, as the opioid crisis, you know, intensified. It all happened at the same time. So this correction was in 54 is to repair what needed to be corrected in 91. And it's just the beginning of a process. Again, we have a lot more work to do.
Yeah, because and I think it's worth noting that I believe that not even all the provisions of Senate Bill 91 had been, you know, scheduled to go into effect before people started saying, we don't believe that this is quite working out right. So, it is a long, lengthy process, and it's something you have to keep coming back to, it seems like, as conditions change and situations change sort of on the ground, yeah.
There's no question about that. There's two more phases to come into play in Senate Bill 91, and that's where we're going to do a lot more of the pretrial work, and it's a lot more work with the conditions of release. Here's the deal. If you have a low-level criminal and it's a first-timer, you think you can turn their lives around, you find that it has to do with substance abuse of some kind, you can get them into a treatment program, perhaps the right path is, all right, this is a first-timer. We're going to put you into a treatment program. If you're successful and you don't reoffend, we're going to help you move on with your life. If you break the deal, so to speak, and you continue to reoffend, then you're going to serve the original sentence that was laid out before you. And that's sort of the philosophy of 54 as it's been, as we recognize the gaps in 91.
Presenting a choice.
There's always a choice. They've already made the wrong choice by being in that situation. I'm a strong advocate of personal responsibility. I can come up with all kinds of socioeconomic reasons about why they've made that choice, but my job is not to necessarily understand what got them in that condition. It's to try to help them out of it. They continue to make bad choices. My first priority is to protect the law-abiding.
Very good. I'm glad that we got to hit on that, and interesting to see what might be ahead for crime reform bills as we move forward in this special session and maybe even beyond that a little bit. Wanted to get to the other part of the special session, which has gotten some attention. Seems like maybe not quite as much of attention as the crime reform things have gotten during this special session, but also being discussed is, of course, the state's fiscal situation, and something that's changed, I think, probably since the last time you and I sat down for a good long few minutes to talk about this is the outlook seems to maybe be not quite so dire in terms of Alaska's big cash register up there on the North Slope. Tell us what's going on with Senate with finances and how I guess you're viewing things from the Senate and some of the proposals that are out there from the administration.
Well, that's a good question, sort of the question of the day. So, the bill that the governor has dropped is Senate Bill 4001, and that's the payroll tax, and it's sort of set around the permanent fund dividend, right? So it's staying within that structure, although out-of-state non-resident workers would be paying the same amount as resident workers. It's a payroll tax. It's an income tax. Roughly, it's 1.5% of your income. It's capped at twice last year's dividend, the last year's dividend. So think about a $2,200 dividend, which the governor reduced 2 years ago to $1,000. Now it's $1,100.
Yeah, we remember that.
this would, just for this year, think about if it were law this year, that remaining $1,100, if you earn $25,000 a year, the tax would be $375 at 1.5%, so you would get the remaining second half or half of your dividend at $725 instead of $1,100. If you earn $75,000 a year, that's kind of the break-even point. You wouldn't get a dividend. And if you earned $150,000 a year, you'd hit the cap of $2,200. So not only wouldn't you get the $1,100 dividend, but you would pay in an additional $1,100. So it's a flat 1.5%. There's no progressivity to it. It would bring in approximately $350 million a year. Then there's the actual situation in Juneau. There's the Senate. I'm a member of that. Again, being the majority leader, we have proven that the gap will close in time. That was before the latest news. The latest news is a third year of increased production on the slope. There's $1 billion of work going on in the slope. The finds in the NPRA are exciting. There are fields that will be coming online that will increase production at some proportion, potentially significantly, 100,000 plus barrel range. The price seems to be improving. We've seen over the last couple of weeks the price of oil is improving. Suddenly takes a lot of the fuel away from the revenue outlook. However, what's missing, and this is something I've been pushing for 5 months, Senate Majority has been pushing for the last 3 months, was that what we really needed, instead of a special session where the government is paying for per diem and the expenses of a special session, was to get together in Anchorage some key leaders from the Senate, key leaders from the House, majority and minority members from both, and the administration to talk about all the assumptions about why we are where we are as a Senate and why the Democrat-led majority in the House believes that we need a larger, I mean, their original bill was a $750 million income tax. Well, we don't have a $750 million gap. None of the models that, if a POMV is successful, none of the models that the administration is putting out shows a gap of that size. And that gap seems to be shrinking with the increased production. You have a lease sale going on right now that closes on December 4th, which is the remaining significant acreage surrounding the NPRA discoveries that we're seeing. A lot of interest from a lot of companies, perhaps a lot of new companies that are the size that we'd like to bring to Alaska. You've got the ANWR considerations being processed in Congress that could open new acreage that is believed to have substantial reserves. Things are looking up. We're in the middle of a recession that seems to be somewhat stabilizing. The Senate's stand is this is the wrong time to move forward with significant revenue bills. However, had we been able to come together and spent October and November in Anchorage, in public view, in a large venue where the public could come and experience that interaction, perhaps we could have found some common ground about a midpoint that we might consider funding at this point.
That gets, at least in part, to sort of the fun parlor game of these special sessions and where the legislature conducts its business, and maybe we can get to that a little bit more. But back to the point of the idea that this problem seems to be, I don't know if you read your colleague Senator Pete Kelly had an op-ed that made its way around to various news outlets. And just to cut to the chase, he ends it with saying the Senate will support new revenues, and this is essentially what you were saying. The Senate will support new revenues only when it's proven to be in the best interest of Alaskans as a whole and not just their government. It's pretty standard Pete Kelly kind of a thing, but that seems to be the vibe among the Senate majority anyway.
Well, it really is, and that doesn't mean that we're saying no, and it doesn't mean that we're not willing to sit down and take an objective view of the actualities of our financial situation right now, right? But what it does mean is when you drop a bill and you go to Juneau in a bicameral model like we have, you're sort of naturally separated from sitting down and discussing that gap. That needed to occur. And I've spent some time with Democrat leadership of the House, and they agree. I we doubt that it's going to move forward. They don't like this bill. They feel that it's regressive and it's not enough money. We don't like the bill because we're not sure that we need new revenue sources. I don't think anyone realizes that if you're able to maintain a 2.25% growth rate in escalation of the cost of your government from today's dollars, that we close the gap in time. I mean, here's a model that I have that shows it closing by FY24.
What's that? Is that growth dependent on increased and continued production off the North Slope, or what is that 2.4% growth predicated on?
These assumptions are on the fall forecast. So these are actual numbers that we use, that we've used every year to determine what we expect the cost of government to be and what we expect the level of revenue to be in the future. So the question is, do we plan on increasing spending above that 2.25%? The Senate's position is we believe we can stay relatively flat for 2 or 3 years. Everything that you do to increase the cost of your government below that 2.25% growth rate shrinks that gap and closes it sooner. So that's our position, is that the discussion needs to take place outside of the closed doors of Juneau, if you will. And by closed doors, I don't mean meetings. I mean that we're sequestered to what filters out of Juneau, as opposed to being in a very transparent process in downtown Anchorage, Alaska, where families from the Kenai can drive up and watch as they have in special session. That doesn't happen in Juneau. That discussion needs to occur. And I think it's the only fruitful way forward for both sides to really kind of get their belief system out there. Let the public understand why we have the position we have, and why the House has the position they have, and perhaps we find some common ground that's arrives at a solution that both sides can support.
It's maybe let's get into that a little bit. This idea that more legislative. I haven't heard you quite say the magic words yet. Move the Capitol to Anchorage, but that more legislative action or more committee meetings, more things like this might be better held in a more centralized location like Anchorage. Talk about that a little bit. Why is that? I mean, it's beneficial for a public access portion of it, but you know, a lot of things that we hear about sort of dysfunction at the federal level is this idea that lawmakers are always sequestered and they're off in their corners and they're fundraising and never get a chance to just sort of be together and hang out together, essentially. In Juneau, you do kind of get that opportunity because you are sort of sequestered down there. So you would think that, at least looking at it from that vantage point, that being sequestered down there might lend itself to more possibilities to find common ground to bridge some of those gaps ideologically, but that's not happening. Do you think that moving it to a more sort of well-lit place to have some of those debates would usher in some more bipartisan cooperation, or is that even the goal?
In my view, Shailen, there's no question about that. I think Juneau is an alternate reality. You arrive in a place where you're in this tiny little building where you expect that people would be able to gather and find common ground, but really you have the House and the Senate. We weren't any closer when it was a Republican-led House. I mean, you just naturally have these two teams. And the reason I use the word sequestered is because all the information that comes out of Juneau is filtered by various news outlets. The ADN leaned heavily left for a while, and the message was filtered with that lens. Perhaps it may lean further right now with the new ownership, and it may be equally filtered from the right. I don't know that people can adequately understand what's happening there without it being in a more accessible place. So when I think of the average working family from the Kenai, that has four kids. Okay, let's go with three kids. Okay? At $600 a round trip, with five people, it's a $3,000 bill to come watch for a few days without lodging, without food at Juneau prices, which is a very expensive place to go. In Anchorage, they could likely go stay with a relative. They would just, I believe the interaction would be much healthier. Would I support moving the Capitol to Anchorage? I'd probably leave the Capitol in Juneau. I would probably support moving the legislature to Anchorage. But at the very least, we should have as much of the legislative process take place in a central community on the road system as possible. Even if we didn't move the legislature, key hearings should occur in a place where the public can engage without the filter of even a responsible press placing their own spin on the actual occurrences that are happening in Juneau.
Very good. Yeah. No, transparency is, I think, always a good thing. Do you think that, I mean, certainly by virtue of the fact that it would be that, that having committee meetings and having part of the legislative process happening in Anchorage or some other more centralized location, just by virtue of that, you would probably have more public engagement. But do you think it would be to the scope where all of a sudden people are having a better comprehensive, on a wide scale, a better comprehensive understanding of things like we're talking about here, where we're talking about bridging the budget gap and how this, you know, a certain tax proposal relates to the permanent fund and how we're using earnings from the permanent fund into the budget? And do you think that something like that would help to educate people in that way? Or,
well, I think those that are going to engage are more likely to engage if their government was more accessible. There are some that are never going to engage. There are some that actually get their news from Facebook, from the last post they read, and they end up believing what this person's interpretation of what's going on in Juneau. And then you'll see people climbing onto that, and you just think, wow, could you come to a committee meeting? You can go on to, you know, 360 North, and you can actually listen. You can watch. It's fairly accessible.
And over the weekend, there were a lot of the House was working late through the weekend, and there was some, well, I mean, for someone like me, there's some good stuff over the weekend. There are ways to access it. But again, it feels, you know, trying to watch that live on Sunday evening at midnight, that's maybe a bit of a stretch.
People will choose their reality shows. This is one that I think has some fairly good theater. And I think it makes it easier to sort of separate. I think when you watch a hearing or you watch the House floor, or the Senate floor, if you engage, instead of getting it from a snippet on one of the news stations or from your newspaper, I think you get a better sense of who's grandstanding to get a statement out there versus those with their head down saying, I want the very best outcome to reduce crime in this state, get the treatment we need, get moving along in a more positive direction, right? You're going to find that a fairly healthy proportion of the legislature is worried about winning the next race and will say things and do things with that focus in mind. And then you're going to be able to see the people that really are doing their homework and want the best outcome for the people of Alaska, not for themselves, but for the people of Alaska. If you're getting it from the news and you're not watching any of the hearings and you're not engaging in the process, I think it's impossible to know the difference.
Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, we could do a whole other conversation on your experience as an elected official with, you know, just dealing with the media and people's media literacy in some instances and how all this plays out. I guess just real briefly, maybe to kind of wrap this portion of the conversation up, I'm curious, you know, in your time in the Senate, has that changed? Has it become more of an isolated thing, and are lawmakers more worried about what they're seeing in various media outlets and how that plays with perhaps the folks back home? Or has that always been there and it's always been relatively the same? Or is it intensifying? Or are lawmakers kind of succumbing to this idea that there are certain areas that you can go to get your message across and certain areas that you don't want to, and that's how you educate certain people in a certain way? And
yeah, I mean, I think so. I try to have as many public meetings as possible. I think it's the best way to interact. And then when someone asks a question, the whole room hears it. I mean, typically my public meetings have been a packed house. You know, I think it's been pretty effective around the district, and that's from here to Seward. That's my favorite way to interact. Even the questions that really perhaps are not someone who doesn't have a complete outlook on what's going on in Juneau, those are the best questions because you can answer them. I mean, always respectfully. Not everyone is tied into the process. People are working for a living. They don't have the time to engage all the time. But That's my favorite way. You know, the part that's least effective is you, and this is nothing against the media because they do the best they can, but, you know, these are smaller markets, and they send a new guy down to Juneau to cover something, and he's fresh out of journalism school. He has no financial background, and these are very complicated issues, and they do the best they can, but I can't tell you how frustrating it is to watch a news story sometimes to say, ugh, that's not what happened, that's not what's happening, and that's we have to improve the way that we communicate with the public, because if they're getting it from this story, they have no way of understanding the complicated issues that we're facing right now. And it's the same way in the legislature. When billions were flowing because we had excess revenues over expenses, it was probably a lot easier job to be a legislator.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's so much easier to say yes than to say no.
It is. And we are having to look at things that were previously regarded as the third rail. It may still be. And we're having to talk about revenue. And we're having to cut services that people have depended on for years. And we're having to talk about the permanent fund dividend and whether or not it's going to be reduced for the long term or it's a temporary option to get us out of this recession, right? So some of those legislators that have served for a long time that had a pretty easy go for 10 or 15 years are suddenly finding themselves with very, very difficult choices. Some of them are not handling it well. And some of us new guys, right? I mean, so by 14... I was faced with a dramatic reduction in the value of oil and therefore dramatic reduction in revenue. So it's kind of been what I've been dealing with since I got into the legislature.
A little bit of a baptism by fire kind of a thing.
Absolutely. But I don't know the easier years, right? I had one 90-day session in 14. And, you know, now all I've known is these tougher calls, which is what's taking the time. People are having a very difficult time pushing the green button on some of these tougher choices. So to give the legislators some credit, the job description has expanded dramatically from something that was relatively manageable, that had lots of extra dollars associated with it, as far as what you can spend in the public realm, to something that's pretty tight. Suddenly everyone's looking with a microscope at what you spend on per diem and how much legislators are paid and how much staff you carry and how much of your office account that you spend and things like that. They should have always managed that responsibly, but now there's suddenly a microscope on that those processes, and it's become a much more difficult job.
Well, and I have to imagine that as a legislature, if you are earnestly trying to get something done, whatever that thing might be, if you're also having to deal with all these other issues of travel and, you know, having to deal with questions about where the capital should be, for God's sakes, you know, that all hampers the process a little bit and draws it out even longer.
Well, and then you look at the regional representation, right? So the folks in Southeast are going to fall on that sword of not moving the legislative process away from Juneau. They count on it. It's part of their economy.
Sure.
The folks in places like this would like to bring more people or bring the process more in touch with the people. Then you've got all the folks from the actual, you know, rural areas of the state, Northwest and Western Alaska, that are kind of caught in that balance. I mean, you have those regional issues. I think the regional issues are being lessened by the fiscal realities of the state. I think that people are actually coming more together. You don't see those regional divides. You see more of a philosophical divide mm-hmm. on whether or not we need more revenue or we can manage our way out of this. So that brings it back to that key issue that now the administration seems to be agreeing on. I mean, Commissioner Fisher is now reaching out to the groups to gather a smaller group, perhaps more transparently, to talk about those differences and find some common ground. And unfortunately, the dropping the bombs of these, you know, revenue measures and these different things has not worked for the Walker administration. I think they're starting to listen.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. If as the forecasts have come out and look a little bit sunnier than they have in the past few years, well, and you know, if things have been if production's been up, then they've been, I should say that they, these increasingly rosier forecasts, if the administration's position is changing, or if there's more room for negotiations as the financial outlook comes into a little bit more clearer picture.
Well, you know, that saying of getting out on a limb, I really like that one, because if you think about it, if you get out to those little branches that just really sort of bend down to the ground, it becomes increasingly difficult to climb back up toward the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, as an elected official, you just have to say, you know, that was then, and this is now. And things are looking better, and we have to look at the actual numbers from today and decide the right way forward. And it's different than it was in 15. We had a $4 billion budget deficit in 15. We're down to just over half of that right now without the use of the POMV. If we go to a POMV from our earnings, whether or not we pay a full dividend.
And in the interest of education and understanding for the folks at home, POMV...
It's an endowment model, a percent of market value of our savings. So we have the blessing of a $61 billion savings account.
Yes.
That spins off a remarkable amount of earnings. You could use a percentage of those earnings to pay that $2.3 billion budget gap. And then suddenly, guess what?
Mm-hmm.
If you're up a couple hundred million dollars in earnings from revenue, oil and gas earnings, and you use a POMV, suddenly that gap lessens or disappears. So things are different than they were in 15. They're much better. We have just over half of that budget deficit, and we need to use today's numbers, try to find some common ground, and provide some solutions that bring stability, not only today, but in the future for the state. Because I believe we have, it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. We've been so slow to move in that direction to demonstrate that we have that stability, that I believe that a lot of investors in the state of Alaska have really held back. I believe that we have caused a much worse recession, even though the recession is only a fraction of what it was in the late 80s, early 90s. I believe we'd be climbing out of it today if we would just make those decisions and move forward.
I wanted to ask one more kind of broader tax question before we move on to some more. I want to hit a couple local things while I've got you here, too. But we always seem to hear when financial times are tough, and we've heard this, you know, over the last few years with statewide finances, that, you know, a downtime in the economy, a recession in the economy, that's no time. Or that's not a very good time to look for new revenues, to start looking to tax people. And that's a fair argument. You know, it's times are tough, times are tough. Could this also be looked at now as we're, again, seeing maybe perhaps some light at the end of the tunnel? Because could this be an opportunity perhaps, not necessarily for the Senate majority as it stands right now, but to look at some way to put in some things that would be very low impact sort of revenue things right now that would be kind of, I guess, sort of long term, and essentially is now a good time to put some small scale tax in place so that people get used to it, so the next time this thing happens, it's already there and we don't have to have this argument.
Well, that's an interesting concept. You know, do you want to be the one of the 41 states that has an income tax, or do you want to be one of the nine that doesn't? And I personally want to be one of the nine that doesn't. You know, we have 422,000 jobs in the state of Alaska. About 60,000 of them are from people from somewhere else, right? Seasonal fishermen and oil and gas people and construction workers and things like that. So about half the people in the state are working. I would like more of the people in the state to be working. Do we want to penalize the behavior that we value? Okay, so there's two ways to look at that. The more you earn, the more you can afford. Sometimes the more you earn, it's the harder you work. You've made tough choices. You had student loans for years. We all make choices in life, and I'm not looking down on folks that are working hard and earn a low wage. That's just the realities of life, right? But I don't know that I'm going to make a choice that we need revenue, because someday we may be in another negative outlook. Or in a similar position that we're in today. We've been here several times in the past. What I will say is that we need a system. And that system says that if we get in this position and we continue to manage what we're spending responsibly, right? We keep it below that 2.25% escalation that's associated with inflation more than growing services, right? If we get into that situation and oil and gas revenue is inadequate, we need a system in place that kicks in, that delivers a certain level of revenue. That conversation we're willing to have because that may be a reality for the future. It's we are not going to produce oil and gas forever, and we need a system in place that responds to those changes. That conversation should be occurring. So it could have triggers and sunsets and things that lets Alaskans know that we're going to pay our bills and that we have a certain level of constitutional services that we're required to deliver, and most of them have been tested in the courts. So with that in mind, I think that's where we can find the common ground, where perhaps we don't slap a progressive income tax in place today in the middle of a recession, but that Alaskans know that we've made the right decisions to cover our costs in the future if we find ourselves in the same position. And that's where the Senate stands. We've never said, no, we're not willing to consider these things. We're saying, hey, let's look at real numbers today. Let's look at what can happen in the future. And let's look at a horizon of and conditions that may require other revenue sources in the future.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I wanted to take just a few moments here, because, gosh, we've been here for quite a while already, but to talk about some of the things that have been happening here locally. Of course, we just saw the thrilling and dramatic conclusion to an incredibly tight Kenai Peninsula borough mayoral race. Any thoughts on that?
No, that was incredibly tight. I congratulate all three of the candidates. And then, of course, when it was narrowed to two, I congratulate both for running a tough race and getting their message out. And it's fascinating that you can get within 45 votes. With the thousands of people. Of course, not as high a turnout for the runoff that I'd like to see. I mean, it's always a problem when so few engage in the process, but congratulations to Mayor Pierce. We certainly look forward to engaging with his administration on any way that I can support him from a statewide or a state level. Thanks to Ms. Farnsworth Hutchings for putting herself out there and running a good race. Certainly hope that I know she'll stay engaged. She's been engaged for years. But people have spoken, and that's how our process works.
So yeah.
Congratulations to everyone, though. I mean, that's tough to be that close for the loser and the winner. You're not handed a mandate.
Yeah.
And if you lost, you didn't lose by much. So
yeah.
It's tough.
It's tough, and it will lead to some very interesting discussions here, you know, locally about the borough finances, because those are definitely conversations that are always happening, and that we talked about a lot during that mayoral race. One other thing I wanted to hit on during the fall elections, one of the huge issues, and this was a thing that drove voter turnout to a potentially historic degree. The borough clerk had never really seen anything like it, was this marijuana issue. And I'm curious if there's anybody paying attention to that, to this new industry within the legislature. Are we focused on sort of the task at hand with finances, or are people looking at this new industry at all in any way? Is there any talk about it? What's the feeling of it in Juneau?
Well, there's no question that, you know, I mean, there's no question that people are paying attention. And that comes from a couple of different facets. Of course, we want to make sure that we manage it well, to avoid negative impacts from the industry. And we're always appreciative of new sources of revenue. You know, it looks like we could perhaps have a $12 million a year of revenue that may increase. We know that there are negative impacts from cannabis, right? So we need to manage those, just like we manage them with alcohol and other substances. However, since it passed in the initiative, I feel that the people have spoken, and I've been pushing for meeting the expectations of the public on the initiative. I didn't support the initiative, but it passed handily. It passed by a higher proportion than any other statewide candidate. And now that it's passed in the borough with such a landslide, yeah, the reality of it is it's here to stay. And my job is to manage it in a way that has fair processes for those that want to engage in the industry, but also with adequate protections for public safety and exposure to youth and that sort of potentially negative interaction. So it's here to stay. We'll see what kind of revenue source it ends up being in the future. I wish all of the folks that found it important for the general perhaps would have shown up for the special election. We want them to be engaged. I'd like to see a higher voter turnout in every aspect. But I've been contacted by a lot of industry folks that don't like the way that the board is moving forward, and we're going to stay engaged with that. We expect the board to listen to the wishes of the people, yet manage it in a way that has the least amount of negative impacts. Sometimes they get out on a limb and need a little direction as well. And sometimes the wrong board members are on board, and we need folks that have a more objective outlook on how things are going to move forward. So, as you know, I have a Title IV rewrite, which is the alcohol bill, and we're going to be trying to get that across the finish line. Those regulations, which have had far more negative impacts in the state of Alaska than any other substance, it's still number one. Even with the opioid crisis, mm-hmm, alcohol, the negative impacts associated with alcohol in the state of Alaska have a far more negative reach across the board than any other substance. So we are working to revamp those 35-year-old regulations to adjust to today's alcohol industry with a focus on public safety and a healthy industry. And we hope to get that across the finish line this year as well.
Very good. And I wanted to just kind of wrap up speaking about public engagement and getting folks involved. I know you've been doing reaching out for a survey, right? Doing that annual thing.
We have.
And so any results yet, or how can people engage? How can people let you know what they think?
Well, they can always call us, which is I try to call everyone back, even though we get thousands of phone calls. They can call 283-7996 and say, I want Machiki to call me about this, whatever this may be. They can send us an email at senator.peter.machiki@akleg.gov. They can stop me on the street as they do. It's tough to walk through the grocery store these days, no matter how many kids I have with me. And we will have more public meetings. We will have several in each community. We'll have one in each community before we go down to Juneau. I will get out the results of the poll. It was similar. People favor sales tax if we have to go to revenue, but they want more cuts before they want revenue. And over half are in favor of a POMV with a reduction or a cap on the permanent fund dividend. You know, if I can touch on that, certainly never dreamed that that was going to be something that we're dealing with. And I hope that any impacts on the dividend is temporary as we climb out of this. I think that's an important institution in the state of Alaska. I may do what I can to defend it, make sure that it runs in perpetuity. But these are tough choices. I'm going to make the best. I'm going to gather the information the best I can. I hope I'm in the, you know, top 1 or 2% of all legislators on being informed. I try to help inform other legislators, but the public's interaction with me is something I value every day. So reach out to us, let me know how you feel, and we'll keep the newsletters and public meetings, town halls coming, and we hope you show up and let us know how you feel.
All right, very good. And dates for those town hall meetings, those will be announced soon?
So as soon as we are out of public, or we are out of special session, and I understand what our pre-holiday schedule will look like, I will get them scheduled, and I'll get that schedule to you to get out to the public.
Sure.
Get it on Facebook and in our newsletter. And we always have a packed house, so we know that people are getting the news. If we need to have more, we will, whatever it takes.
All right, very good. Senator Peter Machiki, thanks so much for coming in today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for the invite, Shaylin. Anytime I can show up and help get the news out, we're happy to do that.
All right, very good.
You still don't have this month's rent because, you know, in the last year you've only actually shown up on time twice, and I'm fine with that, but you want your mineral rights? What property do you own?
Yeah, there's another. There's.
Oh, wait a minute. I don't own any property, so why would I have mineral rights? And how long have you been
really
here?
Do you really have renters that want a cut of mineral rights?
That's what's what the PFD is.
Oh, okay.
Right? That's their logic. The government took our mineral rights, so they gave us a PFD instead. Well, you don't own property, so that logic's out the window.
Yeah.
You're still going to get $1,100 of free government money. And you're complaining that you didn't get $2,200.
And also, by the way, we fought tooth and nail so that you don't have to pay any income tax. Yeah,
when did it become a salary? And the Republican Party deciding that, so they have this thing they want us to sign, that we're going to support a full dividend, that if we're going to put income taxes in place, we're going to send it to a vote of the people, and that we're going to repeal Senate Bill 91. I am never going to sign that. That is just fascinating. If you give back the whole dividend, you require an income tax. There's no other way to manage it.
Yeah.
I mean, was there anyone with a calculator in that room when you this brain trust decided to vote on this thing?
That's the fun thing about dealing in large sums of money that are in kind of different spots like that, is you can find a lot of ways to spit out a lot of different numbers that serve a lot of different purposes. I'm sure. I don't know. I don't have those.
The reason I show it consistently the same every time is because it I can show that I'm looking at the same thing every time. I'm not spinning anything. Some of them actually believe that we've gone up in what we're spending when you combine undesignated general fund, which is the only thing they should care about, designated general funds and federal funds. The number has still come down at that same angle. It's a higher proportion of federal funds since Medicaid has expanded.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a lower number. Somehow they've convinced themselves. And when I actually sat down with Laura Reinbold, she had all of the wrong spreadsheets from legislation and things that never passed. So it's not actual numbers that were. Why do you argue for that?
Because it's the argument that proves your point. It doesn't have to convince anybody but yourself, apparently.
I test a lot of sources, close friends that are Democrats, Republicans, and Independents to see if I'm ever spinning anything. Am I spinning? Do you feel like I'm spinning? If I use the same numbers every time, I don't change it, I don't say, well, heck, you know, we can... We would like to continue reducing our spend, but realistically, my goal is to stay flat for 3 or 4 years and then start moving up with inflation. There's not $500 million left. If the Senate's numbers would have passed the House, we'd be $500 million lower. We would have been a couple years ago. We'd be adding back in right now to public safety. We'd be adding back into education. We'd be adding back in because the public screams would be so, okay, so you're going to close the Pioneer Homes?
Yeah.
Are you going to stop giving money for families with, you know, special needs kids that have no other way to manage it? I mean, I'm not going to cut that stuff. So let the Republicans fire me. I don't give a damn. I mean, that's fine. I'm going to walk out of there holding my head high because I think those things are important. I think they're constitutionally required. I think helping the most vulnerable is very clearly defined in the Constitution. It doesn't mean that we're going to do fancy community centers anymore. It doesn't mean we should be doing, you know, artificial turf fields in every school in the state of Alaska. But the other stuff is an absolute requirement. And when Mike Dunleavy talks about cutting $1 billion, list all those things, Mike, because you will have to close Pioneer Homes. You're going to have to stop senior services. You're going to have to stop day habitation services for the severely handicapped. Put that out on the table. And let's see how accepting people are of those cuts. Because they will fry you alive.
As long as you're not proposing any cuts to the people you know are going to vote for you and get away with it. I heard in the, and I don't know, maybe it's always been like this and I just haven't been around long enough to know it. Charlie in particular talking about his base. And I can get it to some degree at state level politics, but that idea that you're just playing to this certain sect of people who are going to get you into office, that that's filtering down to the borough level is disheartening, I think.
Well, it almost got Fred Sturman elected. And frankly, that's something I have to think about every day. I think I'm the best candidate for being in the legislature for District O right now. It's someone that could match me, that could be as good as Mike Navarre. He's not running. He gets it. He knows the numbers. He's a little left of center. I'm a little bit right of center. I'm not much right of center.
I don't see probably as much difference between you and Mike on state-level stuff.
No. No, there isn't. But if I want to go down there and have one of the two of us, so Mike would have a difficult time winning in this district, I have to sound a little bit further right than I am. But that doesn't go as far as making votes that I don't believe in. I'm not going to do that. I have to talk about those things. Or else some right wing nut is going to go down and be a valley, another valley mm-hmm. voice, and mm-hmm. never accomplish anything.
Nope.
So where is that balance? And I'm kind of learning that. I'll have a guy run against me who's going to talk about all the horrible things I've done and try to get the dividend back. Right? If that guy wins, from what I've seen that he's put out, that would be a really horrible outcome for not only District O, but the people of Alaska. You would have another idiot from the valley in the legislature. And that's a really terrible outcome. So that's the political balance that you have to strike. How do you stay far enough right, talk about things from far enough right without compromising your beliefs and what you know has to be done for the state of Alaska? Because when I give that thought about, I've looked at all of the platforms in all 50 states for the Republican Party, and this is the only one that believes that a check from the government is a really good thing for everyone. How does a Republican get there? I mean, so you've got Willikowski and Dunleavy backing up to their extreme wings, running into each other and not believing the other one's actually in the same place. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Populism is an extremely dangerous...
Oh, yeah. Well, because the really tough thing, especially for someone in an elected position to ever say, is that people are short-sighted, narrow-minded, and not particularly interested in hearing stuff that they don't want to hear, even if it, in the end game, is to their benefit. A lot of interesting quotes about the type of democracy that people deserve in a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, and you're seeing on the national stage.
We want a reality show president, now we're getting a fucking reality show.
There's nothing less presidential than communicating on Twitter.
My new favorite Twitter feed is a bot that takes all of Trump's tweets and frames them in a memo from the president's office of the White House. Just puts them in a nice little piece of stationery in its own Twitter feed. So it comes out as a memo from the president. Because that's what it is. It should be official communication. He's communicating with the public. That's on the record. Might as well be a memo.
How did we get in that position? I mean, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, there were some, particularly on the Republican side, there were some fine candidates. I mean, the only smart Bush ran and could get no traction. He's a good man. I mean, I'm from Florida. He was a great governor, pretty middle of the road, smart guy. I mean,
What I think the most telling thing is the number of people who, when he got to the general in 2016, just weren't sure if they were going to vote for Trump, weren't sure if they were going to vote for Trump if he got it or Sanders if he got it. Like, how are those two names, how are you juggling that, which one to go for? says so much about where the overall electorate is at, that so many people are like, I don't know, Bernie Sanders is far out there and different. Donald Trump's far out there and different. I'm just going to go for whoever's far out and different.
Wow.
Make you want to run for U.S. Senate as an independent someday?
Well, I can tell you right now, being an independent would be is something on the back of my mind when the parties do really stupid things. It just makes me want to go, and the D's are just as bad as the R's.
Well, and right, and you're seeing it on both sides. The Democrats are eating themselves alive, too, at the party level. Republicans have been trying to cut off their nose and spite their face for years, and Democrats are doing it, too.
Oh, I've called Tuckerman a couple times recently. So, what are you doing? You put out a thing that made Chris Tuck sound like the demon, and two of the three things that put him in that category are things that almost every Republican supported. We all supported 91, and we all supported reducing the dividend. So what are you doing?
It begs the question, what's the point of party politics if the parties can't even agree on anything anymore?
I think it would be so liberating to just say, you know what, I'm not doing the party thing anymore. No caucus with the Republicans, I'm fine with that. But you guys are idiots. And all you care about is winning the next race. I care about making a better planet. Those two things don't work together. The D's are worse. I've gotten a big... Berta Gardner and I are very close. She signed on that thing about beating Republicans, replacing Republicans in every district in the state that had Republicans. And I called her up, said, you want to replace me? She said, no, it's ridiculous. I said, well, I have this letter that one of my Democrat friends gave me that's upset with you because they support me. Because I'm not a partisan guy, and they got a letter from you, said, you want to replace me? She said, what do you mean? I said, wait a minute. She said, I just hadn't really thought about it like that. I said, you will never see a letter like that from me. There are good Democrats, there are good Republicans, there are bad Democrats, there are bad Republicans, and I want the best people we can have down here. I'm not going to choose my friends by the letter next to their name. Just not. I just really didn't think about it like that. So it's out there, Berta. Don't get carried away with this partisan nonsense.
It's another one of those things that tries to take complicated issues and boil them down into something simple and boilerplate that you can just have a knee-jerk reaction to, because that's so much simpler than a nuanced conversation and any level of understanding. I'm not talking about total comprehension, but just some level of understanding of the scope of a problem or who might be affected by a decision that's made. You know, people don't give a shit about that stuff.
Yeah, it's a frustrating job. As you could probably imagine. Especially when you're sitting down there and drilling something into someone's head for months on trying to understand something, and they get on the Senate floor and say stuff where you just go, oh my God, he or she doesn't understand any part of any of this, but they're still talking anyway, you know?
Because they can, because that's all you gotta do as a politician, right? Just be able to talk ad nauseum about anything. I was glad you brought up some of that media stuff, though, because the loss of institutional knowledge is depressing.
The ADN thing was really hard to watch. I mean, we were the political plaything of a very wealthy woman from somewhere else.
Oh, yeah.
And I just... I don't know if you knew Parnell. I don't know if you believe the negative things you heard about Parnell, but I will tell you this. Him and his wife Sandy are some of the nicest freaking people I have ever met. I never saw a crooked thing. I never saw a non-transparent thing. And they just
found these things, the rate of abuse in the National Guard has not gone down since Parnell got out of office. It was in the paper every day. Mm-hmm. There actually has been a higher fatality rate in the Department of Corrections since Parnell got out. And they don't talk about a thing. I mean, they beat him up about these horrible things. And Sean's like me. He said, well, I'm going to go to work every day, and by golly, if I lose it, I lose it. And he lost it. And all of the things they said about Parnell, the Walker administration is doing, and the Parnell administration didn't do, on the paying out for all these extra folks that are helping on projects, and the lack of transparency, and there being a muzzle on his commissioners. And I had frank conversations with all of them. I will tell you right now that when you get into a meeting, you disagree with the administration, now a commissioner will not talk. They will stop talking. They have a muzzle on them like you wouldn't believe. Senate Bill 91 stuff, the things we have to fix, they knew about it, but did not say a word when we were processing the bill, because they were told it's going to pass and I'm going to sign it and you love it. So when you think about what Alice Rogoff did, I mean, that's really disturbing. I mean, I'm from the Maria Downey School of Journalism, and the woman's like as pure as they come. She tries her best to do, I mean, she's an anchor woman now, but when she was a young reporter, I mean, reporters are supposed to report on the news, not create the news. And she created news for a year and a half, you know? It's just, I don't know. How do we keep that from happening? It's such an important job. You have such an important job.
Because information, regardless of the context, is not valued in a way that it once was. And we don't have, we certainly don't have anybody like Walter Cronkite who can be the thumb on the pulse of the nation. That's just out the window. We finally recognize that we're a diverse enough country that one guy can't do it anymore. I don't know what the answer is. People just don't value information. They expect it to be there, but they don't care how good it is, how accurate it is. They just expect that their questions will be answered and that they'll feel good about that answer. And one of the reasons you don't see somebody being a beat reporter at a Capitol building anymore is because you get to the, you know, you get to be in your 40s and 50s and you go, I don't want to be making 5% more than I was fresh out of college. This is enough of this. It's, you know?
So, is there no market for better news?
If you can figure out how to get people to pay for it, how to get advertisers to support it in a way that does not compromise good news coverage, if you can figure out that business model, then you don't need to worry about running for elected office again, because you will have 18 homes around the world that you can go to anytime, and you will be so rich beyond your wildest dreams. I don't know that the model exists anymore.
Well, it changes history.
Well, I don't want to go that far.
Oh, how could it? Alice Rogoff changed Alaska history forever.
Oh, okay, all right.
About how close that race was. Parnell would have won.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you should favor Parnell over Walker, but it took a different direction and it changed history forever. It changes history. Mm-hmm. Who your next elected official is, and if it's based on things that are not balanced or fair, the historic change is impure. It's based on selected information.
That's a lot to lay at the news media's doorstep.
Well, I'm giving you one example where it occurred.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the number one paper in the state
changed
2,200 votes. Would you agree with that? Would you agree that the number one paper in the Parnell-Walker race, would you agree that 2,200 votes were changed toward Walker and away from Parnell by the ADN?
It's really tough for me to give the ADN that much credit. change some votes, but it's a lot of minds to change.
Circulation.
Even as an alleged journalist, I doubt the power that journalism has to change that many minds, even in a place like this.
Really?
Kind of do.
Shaylen Sell. Did we decide I got this right finally? Is your phone in here?
Yeah.
Is it ringing? Yeah.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Well, that's me.
Cool.
All right, I gotta go pack. Drive up to Anchorage at 3:30. Give my kids a kiss when they get home from school.
How long are you gonna be down there this time, Ramos?
I don't know. I don't want us to rush. I think this is an important bill. I support the changes. I'm really upset that now that I've called folks out on the carpet privately about why didn't you, learning how much of a muzzle they had. I'm not a corrections expert. I've never been a police officer. I'm not a judge. I'm not a defense or prosecuting attorney. I went with what they told us.
Well,
and we went too far.
Yeah. There's a potential saying that crime reform of any stripe is tough. It's kudos for even wanting to, regardless of what context it was brought up, whether it was savings or actually wanting to do something different, kudos for even trying to bring it up for any reason, because it's tough. You can never, any person who gets out under different circumstances maybe than they would have and does something else, it's a black eye to that reform bill, and anybody, it's just tough.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I definitely want to get it right. My take, which is not a Republican thing, is I want to encourage the best, the highest level of human potential in every individual. And I wasn't perfect when I was a kid. You probably weren't perfect when you were a kid.
No.
But take Jace Robertson, do you remember who that was?
Uh-huh.
He's a kid around here that got a felony DUI when he was 18 or 19. Will never drive again. Oh, wait a minute. We passed Senate Bill 91 and he can. But he was a kid that screwed up like a lot of us do. And he went to KPC and was their number one student. And he got his degree and he got hired in, as an operator for someone here locally. And then he got picked up by a company outside, which is sad. We had crashed by then locally. He got married, he has a beautiful family, beautiful kids. He shouldn't have an obstacle of never driving again in a way that doesn't make sense. Right? Jennifer Waller, Freedom House.
Yeah.
She's a Marcus. She's one from one of the best families on the Kenai. Lost a decade of her life to opioid addiction.
Yep.
She's a beautiful, amazing young woman. I mean, I want her to move on. And so there's a difference. There's that bad guy that comes into my house and rapes my kids who should never see the light of day. And then there's the numbskull that makes a mistake in the young person.
I've been wanting to follow up on this story. I was reading randomly a Trooper Report or something one day, and, the young kid, like, 18 years old, fight with his girlfriend at 16 years old. There's a gun involved. It's bad news. And this kid immediately is off to Wildwood, and he's going to go to jail for this. And I'm just thinking,
didn't he kidnap her?
That was part of it, allegedly. But, anyway, the thing that made me, without taking away anything of that traumatic experience from the victim, is it best for an 18-year-old kid, after going through something like that, to immediately get sent to prison for who knows how long he's there?
Yeah.
Is he not young enough to get at the heart of why he's so angry, why his life has taken this turn, and figure out possibly a path forward? And then is it the state's responsibility to do that?
Well, that may be one of those examples. I remember reading.